Welcome to Practical Christian Living.
The tribulation period is called a time of God's wrath and indignation. We're told in Romans 5:8, 1 Thessalonians 5:8, that we are not going to face the wrath that is to come. So even if that is general wrath that he's talking about there, the tribulation period is wrath as well, and we are not going to face the wrath of God.
Here is one thing we know for sure. As children of God, we, the church, are not going to suffer the wrath that comes during the tribulation period because we are the bride of Christ. We are in Revelation chapter 11 as we study the two witnesses who also are martyrs for Christ. Who are these two witnesses? Here's Robert Furrow, pastor of Calvary Tucson, with Revelation chapter 11, verses 3 through 14.
We're currently in our study in the middle of the book of Revelation. We're in Revelation chapter 11, almost smack dab in the middle. Actually, we'll get another chapter or two before we're right in the middle, but we're basically in the middle of it. And Jesus said that this was the worst time that the world was ever going to see and ever going to see in Matthew 24:21. The tribulation is the worst time this world will ever see and is ever going to see. During this 7-year period, it was broken up into two periods, 2 3.5-year periods. And we get that in our text here today. And basically, this tribulation period is broken up into 21 different judgments or events. There are 7 seal judgments or events. Events are thrown into these judgments. There are 7 trumpets sounding that either sound a judgment or an event. And there are 7 bowls, and I believe the 7 bowls that are poured out, well, I'm just going to say there are 7 bowls that are poured out. I think they're all judgments, so they're poured out. I would say they're all judgments, and then when I read them, there'll be one that's an event. Anyway, that's kind of the outline of the tribulation period, but every so often there's an interlude that's thrown in, a parenthetical passage that deals with something else. Well, we are in a parenthetical passage from the beginning of chapter 10 all the way till chapter 14 of chapter 11. So for a chapter and a half, it's parenthetical. We're getting other information. So first of all, we saw that there was a strong angel with 1 foot in the ocean and 1 foot on the sea, and he had a rainbow around his head, and he had a little book in his hand, and he was told from a voice from heaven, get the little book from the angel. And John said, give me the book. And he said, take it and eat it. And he ate it, and it was sweet in his mouth, but bitter in his stomach. And he said, you must still prophesy after this, telling us there was going to be a sweetness to the prophecy, but a bitterness to it. And when we're following the Lord, that's the truth. There are things that we read that are sweet, and there are things that are bitter. There are things that are easy and lovely, and there are things that are hard and difficult. They're full of those. But then in chapter 11, it was said in verse 1 to get a rod. John, the writer of the book, was told to get a rod and to measure the temple. And we saw last Wednesday night that there is going to be a tribulation temple. There will be a temple rebuilt on the Temple Mount, where the Dome of the Rock is, where the Alaska Mosque is. And yes, I know, if a temple were started today, it would bring on World War III. I realize that. There are going to have to be some things that change in our world, and it may be a war. There seems to be war brewing in the Middle East today, and it may be an all-out war at the end of the war that would allow them to be able to rebuild this temple. But politically, there are those in the Knesset who want to rebuild it. There are a lot more Jews that are talking today, if you go to Jerusalem, about rebuilding the temple. And then all of a sudden, like out of nowhere, comes these two witnesses. And they witness for 3.5 years. And I'm going to take it to be the last 3.5 years because of the way that it ends. I think it's very close to the actual return of Jesus. And remember, this is parenthetical, so it's not in the chronological order that you find when you go through the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. So this is parenthetical. It could be out of order. So we get it in a time, perhaps when it isn't exactly happening because it's an interlude. And here we're just starting. I'm not going to say the really interesting part to the book of Revelation because I think it's all been really interesting. But for me, the stuff we're getting to now is the stuff I get really excited about studying and teaching. We're going to look at the beast that comes out of the sea, the beast that comes out of the land, the dragon of Revelation, the woman with the 12 stars that gives birth to a child, Mystery Babylon, the destruction of Mystery Babylon, the mark of the beast. All of these things are in our future. We're going to be taking a look at those. In that section, That really interesting section to me starts in chapter 11 here with the two witnesses that come on the scene. So I want to pick it up in Revelation 11, verse 3. It says, "And I will give power to my two witnesses." Now, right away, I need to talk about the word "my" there. I will give power to my two witnesses. Because when we were in chapter 10 and we talked about the strong angel, we talked about the different theories that were out there. Some people believe that it's Jesus himself. Some people believe, because it doesn't say it's Jesus, that it's just another mighty angel. Some believe it's Michael the archangel, who was the angel. And to be honest with you, I'm going to have to go back and look. I know I said I lean towards, because I've taken to say that a lot. When they're, instead of being dogmatic about something, and I used to do this as a pastor, and I really wish that I would have learned this a lot earlier in my career as a pastor, to not be dogmatic when something isn't really, you can't be that dogmatic about it. And so it's good enough to say I lean towards this. Like, once saved, always saved. When you get genuinely saved, will you always be saved? Can you lose your salvation? I lean towards that you can't lose your salvation. But every once in a while, I read a passage that makes me go, I don't know. There's a few of them in Galatians, and we just covered Galatians, that you go, I don't know. That looks like you could be in trouble if you head down a certain road. So I lean towards certain ways, and I think I said I lean towards this not being Jesus. However, when you get to verse 3 of Revelation chapter 11, I will give power to my two witnesses. And it becomes evident that the "my" there is God. So it is Jesus. And this is the angel. I backtracked it. I did it today. I just went back and I kept reading back far as I could see to who's speaking. And it's the angel that is still speaking. There's a voice from heaven that tells him to take the rod, but then he's told to measure the temple. So I think that it's the angel speaking, and the angel is Jesus. Just to throw that in, it's a correction on myself. But also, maybe just a lesson for all of us, that when we're studying the Bible, we just got to keep looking. We just got to keep looking and seeing, and we can get direction for what is the right and the wrong way. And for pastors, not to just teach something because somebody has said it before. Because there's so many things that people have said before that are not a reality. Just because you heard it in a sermon doesn't make it true. We need to check and double check everything. And we live in the information age when we can do that. And so we can check and make sure. And if we're not 100% sure, then we just leave it out and we move on. But he says, I'll give power to my two witnesses. And this reminds me of Acts 1:8. And you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you to be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. So we as the church have power to be witnesses all around the world. Now, this word "witness" is an interesting word. It's got a twofold meaning to it. And it's translated both ways in the Bible. It means witness, as in taking a witness stand, being a witness for somebody. Somebody says, did you see that accident? Yes, I did. You are now a witness to the accident. So that word means that. But the word also means martyr, witness and martyr. And it's an interesting word in the Greek that would have witness and martyr kind of intertwined in it. And the way you tell is the context. So there's English words that are like that. They mean one thing in one context. They mean another thing in another context. So the context is going to tell you everything. That's the way this word is. And so if you get out your Strong's Concordance and you look up this word, and I've got an app on my phone that's the Strong's Concordance, by the way. So if you got out your Strong's Concordance on your phone now, you went to Revelation chapter 11 and you clicked on the word "witness," it would tell you down at the bottom how many times it's been translated "martyr" and how many times it's been translated "witness." So you can see that. Now that's interesting to me, because these guys are martyrs. But before it's all done, they're going to be killed. But they witness for 3.5 years. And I'll tell you what's more interesting to me is that you and I, as followers in Christ, are supposed to be witnesses and martyrs. We're supposed to lay down our lives. We're supposed to be living sacrifices, which means we are martyrs. I'm not living for me, I'm living for him. And I want to be consumed by him. I want to live to be whatever, you know, whatever the good old age is. I want to live to be that as long as I'm mobile, all right? I'm just throwing some qualifiers in there. As long as I'm mobile, able to get around good enough, maybe if I can still preach. Charles Stanley just passed away at 90 years old. And I'm in the pulpit almost until, you know, 90 years old. That'd be awesome. I don't know if you guys would still hear me at 90 years old, but But listen to me now. They wanted to hear him, right? So we are witnesses, and we want our lives consumed by him. And so I can see why being a witness for Christ is being a martyr, because we are laying down our lives. Paul put it this way, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I that live, but it is Christ that lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live to the Son of God. Now, even though the tribulation period has the church taken out before it starts, and I've done a lot of studies on this already, there is a resurrection before the tribulation, and those who are alive and remain are caught up to meet the Lord in the air. We will not go through the wrath of God. If the wrath in the tribulation period were just the destruction of the earth or the wrath of Satan or the wrath of man, there would be no reason for the church to be taken out. But because it's the wrath of God, he's not going to pour his wrath out on his bride. He's going to take his bride out beforehand. We have passages that tell us this, like Revelation 3:10, because you have kept my word to persevere, I will keep you from the hour of testing that is coming upon this whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Jesus said in Luke 21:34 through 37, pray that you would be counted worthy to escape all of these things that are going to come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. The tribulation period is called a time of God's wrath and indignation. We're told in Romans 5:8, 1 Thessalonians 5:8, that we are not going to face the wrath that is to come. So even if that is general wrath that he's talking about there, the tribulation period is wrath as well, and we are not going to face the wrath of God. If God gets angry at me, he's going to discipline me as his child. You love your child, you may be wrathful towards them, but your wrath is going to be connected with discipline. That is, if you have a healthy, you know, father-child, mother-child relationship. There's going to be discipline in taking care of your children. God's not a God who would be wrathful without discipline towards his children. Anyway, so the church isn't there. So what does God do after the tribulation period? Well, God raises up 144,000 Jews from 12 tribes, without Dan being mentioned, and he sends them out as evangelists. We see there's 144,000 Jews that are evangelizing around the world. He doesn't leave himself without a witness. And this is Acts 14:17. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven, and in a faithful season, filling our heart with food and gladness. So in that passage, he's saying that even though things were hard and God didn't leave himself without a witness, that you would not be able to see him. I believe that every person alive can look in nature and within what God has placed within them and know that there is a God. And he didn't leave himself without a witness. And so he also has these two witnesses that show up. And he gave power to my two witnesses. Now, there are several thoughts as to who these witnesses could be. Let me give them to you, then I'm going to break them down. Number one, some believe that it is Enoch and Elijah. I'll explain why in a moment. Others believe that it is Moses and Elijah. Some also believe that it's two ordinary people that are called by God, empowered, and do the works of Moses and Elijah as an example of Moses and Elijah. Now, you'll notice the one theme in all of those is Elijah. Why? Because the Old Testament said that Elijah is going to return before the great and terrible day of the Lord. And when we're looking at the book of Revelation, in the last days, the only place we can find where Elijah fits well is the two witnesses. Now, you may be able to find something else. Maybe I'm going to be reading on later on. I'm going to go, you know what? I need to make a correction from what I said in chapter 11, because this certainly looks like it could be Elijah. So when John the Baptist came, the disciples were confused when Jesus said, you know, this is the voice crying in a wilderness. That's the Elijah passage. And so they said, well, is Elijah coming? And he said, well, if you can handle it, John was Elijah, but Elijah is going to come. Listen to what he said to them. This is Matthew 17:10. And his disciples asked him, saying, why then do the scribes say Elijah must come first? Jesus answered and said to them, indeed, Elijah is coming first to restore all things. Now, it seems to me that's not a person with the powers of Elijah, but Jesus is saying Elijah will come first. So the first mystery we have revealed is that one of these guys is Elijah. Now, why else do we think that? Why would we think it could be Enoch? because there are two men in the Bible that never died. This is a good Bible trivia question, by the way. If you're looking to write some questions out for a party at home, a Bible trivia question, who are the two men in the Bible who never died? Enoch and Elijah. It says in Genesis 5:24, and Enoch walked with God and was not, for God took him. In 2 Kings 2:11, it happened that as they continued to talk, that suddenly a chariot appeared. This is Elijah being taken up. A chariot appeared with horses and separated the two. This is Elijah and Elisha being separated. And Elijah went up in a whirlwind into heaven. So God brought Elijah directly up into heaven. Now, Enoch is a Gentile. It seems that these guys are Jewish. They're ministering in Israel. It seems that they are Jewish. Enoch lived before Abraham. Abraham's the father of the Jewish people. So Enoch is Gentile. And I think Enoch is a type of someone walking with God and being raptured before the wrath that would come upon the earth. Enoch would be alive. The lengths of people were living in those days falls within the time of the flood. Enoch would have been alive during the flood, but Enoch was a righteous man and God wouldn't have destroyed Enoch in the flood. He could have got on the boat, but rather than doing that, he gave us an example of a rapture. Jesus said in John 17, as it was in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, so it will be when the Son of Man returns. They are married and drinking in marriage and given in marriage, and then the Son of Man will suddenly come. It tells us that life's going to be going on like normal when the Son of Man comes back. And Lot had to be taken out before there was destruction. So the church has to be taken out before there's destruction. Also, Jesus in the same passage said, as it was in the days of Noah, they were eating, drinking, marrying, given in marriage when sudden destruction came upon them. And Noah and his family had to be caught up into the ark before God could bring the destruction upon the earth, as it was in those days. And so I believe that those things are set up. Now, something very interesting is that they have now discovered the city of Gomorrah. This is something recent. Archaeologists for many, many years, and because one of the major archaeologists in the world believed that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were on the southern part of the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea is a lake that expanded for a long time. It's now getting smaller because the Jordan River is the only river that feeds the Dead Sea is the Jordan River. And it used to flow in without anybody using any of it, so it would grow. But now they're using the water from the Jordan River for agriculture and all kinds of things. And so the Dead Sea is shrinking. Now, someone, and I wish I could remember this archaeologist's name, he's got a book on it, and it's been in major newspapers, by the way. It's been in major journals that the city of Gomorrah has been found. He began to look at the Bible as what the Bible said where Lot went, and he saw he didn't go down towards the Dead Sea. From where they were, it says where they were. And then it says he went east, and it puts them in Jordan, not in the Dead Sea in Israel. And there's still a well-watered plain in the area of Jordan. And so they went and looked in a plain, first of all, found a spot that looked like a tell, that looked like it was a tell, which a tell has a city under it. It's a mountain that has a city under it. They went and excavated, and they found a major city that had been destroyed by fire. And not just a small fire, but by major fire. As I said, you would think this would be all over the news, wouldn't you? Do you know why the Bible says that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed? Because they were rich. They got fat, meaning they had all their goods. They were rich. They got fat. They didn't care for the poor. They just began living for themselves. And we know that homosexuality was part of their lifestyle. Is it any wonder that you haven't heard the city of Gomorrah has been found? It was in some major journals, but nobody else picked it up. It wasn't on CNN. It wasn't on Fox News. Because we're living in a day where you don't want to be the news agency to say, we discovered the city of Gomorrah, and it was burned up by fire, a really hot one. Now, if you want to study it, I wish I had the information for you, but go to Joel Rosenberg's podcast. It's called Epicenter, and I'm going to give you the name. Dr. Stephen Collins is the name of the archaeologist. So he's got an hour or so interview with him as he talks about the discovery of Gomorrah and how he's talked about the fire that was there and how hot the fire was. And this isn't in his area. He's not an archaeologist. So he had other scientists involved to talk about how sudden this destruction was. So Dr. Stephen Myers, if you want to look it up yourself, and he even talks there about how they were in certain journals, but it never got picked up by the main media. And I think there's a reason for that. So I don't think it's Enoch and Elijah. I think that Enoch was the type and that there is something with Elijah. But you say, but wait a minute, didn't Moses die? How could it be Moses and Elijah, which is the second, was it Moses and Elijah? And yes, Elijah died on Mount Nebo as he was looking over into the promised land. In Jude 1, it says, in Jude 1 verse 9, there's only one chapter I think in Jude, yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not to bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. Why would Michael the archangel fight about the body of Moses? What's the reason for that? Seems weird. There are a few reasons why we believe that these witnesses are Moses and Elijah. Number one, they did the same miracles that Moses and Elijah did. They burn with fire out of their mouths. Now, I don't know if this is literal or whether or not he's calling a fire because they say fire and fire consumes them. I don't know, a little bit of dragon in these two witnesses. But remember Elijah, they came to arrest him and Elijah burned him up. He called fire down from heaven. They came to arrest him again. He burned up the second group. The third guy was commanded to go. And the third guy said, listen, I'm a family man. And Elijah said, all right. And he went with him. But they did the same miracles Moses and Elijah. They turn the water into blood. They bring plagues on the land. They call fire down from heaven to consume it. Those are the things that Moses and Elijah did. Elijah was taken alive into heaven. And there was a contention over the body. You might be thinking of Hebrews 9:17. That says, it is appointed once for man to die, and then comes judgment. And that's basically true. Out of billions of people that have lived on the earth, it's appointed once for man to die, and then comes judgment. And so you could say, well, it can't be Moses because Moses died. However, there are exceptions. Like Lazarus, like the little girl Jesus rose from the dead, like the funeral service that Jesus ran into where he raised the man up from the dead. So there's been exceptions in the Old Testament as well. They threw somebody on the bones of Elisha and the guy came back to life again. So there were exceptions. So Moses could just be an exception. He died, God brought him back to life, and he will die again, just like Lazarus did. Now, Jesus met with Moses and Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration, and Jesus fulfilled the law and the prophets. Moses represents the law and the prophets. So these two witnesses for Jesus would be representing the law and the prophets to them. And so this is the reason that I think that it's Moses and Elijah. I lean towards Moses and Elijah.
Thank you for joining us for Practical Christian Living with Robert Furrow, pastor of Calvary, Tucson. We pray that wherever you're listening from, the study of God's Word is encouraging you and strengthening your walk with Christ. If you'd like to hear more of Robert Furrow's teachings, visit calvarytucson.com. Producing this program would not happen without the support and generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to partner with us financially, and Practical Christian Living Radio and TV has blessed you, please visit pclaz.org. That's pclaz.org, where you can make a secure one-time donation or sign on to become a monthly partner on a reoccurring basis. We'd love for you to join us at one of our two campuses in Tucson. Our West Campus is located at 5170 South Julian Drive, and our East Campus is located at 8711 East Speedway. East Campus service times are Saturday evening at 6 p.m. and Sunday mornings at 9:30 a.m. and noon. Our West Campus meets Sunday mornings at 8:15 and 10:45 a.m. Our midweek service times are Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m. at our East Campus and 7:15 p.m. at our West Campus. You can also listen live to our Sunday morning 9:30 service and Wednesday evening 6 p.m. service right here on Reach Radio Tucson at 106.7 FM, 690 AM, streaming at reach.radio or via our Reach Radio app on your Android or iPhone. If you have recently accepted Jesus into your life and you have questions about salvation, we'd love to help guide you in your journey. email us at saved@calvarytucson.com. Don't forget to follow us on social media, Instagram at Calvary Tucson or Facebook at Calvary Chapel Tucson. Our local listeners can watch Practical Christian Living Sunday mornings at 8:30 on KEGA 9 TV. Thank you for joining us for Practical Christian Living, a ministry of Calvary Tucson, where we are reaching for Jesus, connecting with people, and walking in truth.
Calvary Tucson has developed a discipleship school with you in mind. Reach College of Ministry is for adults of all ages who want a deeper relationship with Jesus, a stronger grasp of the Bible, and practical insight into fulfilling your God-given calling. Earn your certificate in theology in as little as 1 year, or enroll in individual courses for personal growth. Attend courses online or in person at Calvary Tucson's East Campus. Visit thereachcollege.org today to learn more and start this exciting journey.